WOR, New York. 10 a.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time. Bulova, gift of a lifetime.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock, VE Day, Monday, May 7th. This is Henry Gladstone reporting from the WOR Newsroom, speaking for the Hudson Pulp and Paper Corporation, makers of Hudson paper towels, Hudson paper napkins, and Hudson tissue. Always remember, Hudson paper products are whiter, crisper, stronger, more pure, and wholesome. And now the news. Here is the great news for which the world has been waiting for almost 6 long years. The Allies have announced that the Germans have surrendered unconditionally. The war in Europe is over. The enemy surrendered unconditionally to the Americans, British, and Russians at 2:41 a.m. this morning, French time, or 8:41 last night, Eastern War time. The capitulation took place at a little red schoolhouse in Reims, France, used as a headquarters by General Eisenhower. Thus it is that 11 months to the day after the invasion of Normandy, since the invasion was the 7th of June, European time, the Allies have utterly smashed the German enemy that came close to enslaving the world. The papers were signed for the Allied Supreme Command by Lieutenant General Walter Bedell Smith, General Eisenhower's Chief of Staff. The new Chief of Staff of the German Army, Colonel General Walter Jodl, signed for Germany to end the greatest war in history. For Russia, General Ivan Sislaparov signed as the representative of Marshal Stalin. General François Sèvres signed for France. The surrender brought the war in Europe to a formal end after 5 years, 8 months, and 6 days of terrific battle. The formal announcement from Eisenhower came after German broadcasts had told the German people that Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz had ordered the capitulation of all fighting forces. The German admiral, who stepped into Hitler's shoes for the last act of the world drama, also called off any possibility that U-boats might try to continue a guerrilla war at sea, as had been feared. Dönitz ordered Nazi U-boat crews to cease fighting. Earlier yesterday, he had ordered German naval and merchant ship crews not to scuttle or damage their vessels. The actual formal announcement of VE Day is still to come. Here's a bulletin that has just been handed to me from Reims, France. General Eisenhower was not present at the signing of Germany's unconditional surrender. However, immediately after German generals Jodl and Freiburg had signed the surrender, they were received by General Eisenhower. The Germans were asked sternly if they understood the surrender terms imposed on Germany and if they would be carried out by Germany. The German generals answered yes. The final German capitulation of the Germans ends more than a week of negotiations. The first Nazi offer was made through neutral Sweden on April 26th by Heinrich Himmler, chief of the Gestapo. And here is a special report by Jack Thompson, mutual correspondent with the First Army in Europe. Go ahead, Jack Thompson.
This is John Thompson with Hodges' First U.S. Army in Germany. The war is over. Just a few minutes ago, we heard from the German radio that Grand Admiral Dönitz had ordered all German soldiers to cease fighting. That means both against the Americans, British, and French, as well as the Russians. It's the kind of news we've all been waiting for, but it leaves everyone seriously tapped. By here, I mean the headquarters of the 1st U.S. Army. The soldiers out on the line, or what's left of the front, down in the 3rd Army sector, probably don't know the news yet. Nor do we know here whether the Allied governments have officially proclaimed VE Day. But it really doesn't matter whether the proclamation is issued or not. The war is over when the Germans stop fighting. The actual news hasn't had a chance to circulate around even the headquarters very much. Soldiers are busy with the manifold administrative details of the headquarters, which go on even when it has ceased to be operational. The German civilians of this town, too, have not heard it yet, as far as I could judge by a hasty check outside on the streets. They are hurrying along with their shopping baskets. The girls occasionally turn to look at these soldiers, and the soldiers, as they always do, stare at the girls if they're pretty. It is somewhat flat to the men over here, for they've been waiting for VE Day for so long. And in the last month, it has been apparent that the war would end at any moment. The different armies and army groups of the Germans started surrendering, and as the days passed and more prisoners came in, the feeling of anticlimax grew and grew. Take PFC Donald Meyer of Reading, Ohio. He is a member of the headquarters security guard, and his post is outside the section where we have our secret mailman. Meyer heard it only a few minutes after I did, and he said, "It sure is good news, but it won't do me much good. I'm tired of studying for the CBI. I'm not old enough to get out of the Army." Lieutenant Robert Kahn of Seattle, Washington, who was acting as the first family's public relations officer, smiled broadly when the word came in. His reaction was also on the sober side. Said Lieutenant Kahn, "That's very good, but there's a lot more to be done on the other side." Lieutenant Colonel Jack Redding of Chicago, press officer for the 12th Army Group, heard the news as he walked into the press room. Jack's reaction was a laugh, because the German radio had announced the cessation of hostilities before the official news came from the Allies. The Jerry's even scooped us on the last story, laughed the colonel. As for me, I was walking in the press room door carrying a case of cognac and getting ready for the party the press is giving General Courtney H. Hodges and his First Army staff. Even that good news was not enough to make my arms relax their control of the precious box. A strange way to hear the news that this war we've been covering for so long is over. Actually, there still may be some fighting here and there. The Wehrmacht, in a few places, has been reported fighting SS troops. And it may not be possible for Admiral Dönitz's surrender order to reach all of his soldiers simultaneously, particularly on the Russian front. But these will be small, sporadic actions, and I doubt if they will involve any Allied soldiers. So to all intents and purposes, the long, long European war has finally ended with a crushing victory for the Western Allies in Russia, a victory won in the West largely by American troops and materiel. They will be celebrating tonight. The soldiers will be having a few drinks if they can liberate some cognac. And the displaced persons, the ex-German slaves, will be whooping it up. But foremost in the minds of the Americans here, there will be constantly the sobering reminder that the war against the Japanese still goes on. Victory in Europe is here. The war is over. But some of these troops will be readied for shipment to the Pacific Theater. This is John Thompson now returning you to Neutral in the United States.
Radio Flensburg, a German station, quoted the German Foreign Minister von Krosigk as announcing that the German High Command accepts unconditional surrender. The Federal Communications Commission, which recorded the broadcast, quotes von Krosigk as saying this: "German men and women, the High Command of the Armed Forces has today, at the order of Grand Admiral Dönitz, declared unconditional surrender of all fighting German troops. As leading minister of the Reich government, which the Admiral of the Fleet has appointed for dealing with war tasks, I turn at this tragic moment of our history to the German nation. After a heroic fight of almost 6 years of incomparable hardness, Germany has succumbed to the overwhelming power of her enemies." The German foreign minister went on, "To continue the war would only mean senseless bloodshed and futile disintegration. The government, which has a feeling of responsibility for the future of its nation, was compelled to act on the collapse of all physical and material forces and to demand of the enemy the cessation of hostilities." Those are the words of the German foreign minister, Count Schwerin von Krosigk, to the German people, telling them that the war is all over in Europe. An official proclamation is expected to be issued at 12 o'clock noon, Eastern War Time. Prime Minister Churchill held a full meeting of the British cabinet at 10 Downing Street this morning. King George VI, who will make a broadcast on the night of VE Day, has returned to Buckingham Palace in London from Windsor Castle, accompanied by Queen Elizabeth, and is standing by awaiting developments. The trend of events pointing toward a VAE Day announcement today started earlier this morning with a German report that all troops in Norway had surrendered. And here's an item that has just come in. London went wild at the news. Crowds jammed Piccadilly Circus. Smiling throngs poured out of subways and lined the streets. Cheers went up in New York, too, and papers showered down from skyscrapers. And here's an ironic note. Germany, which began the war with a ruthless attack upon Poland, followed by successive aggressions and brutality in internment camps, surrendered with an appeal to the victors for mercy toward the German people and armed forces. More news in just a moment. Ladies, you always want your table linens to be starched, crisp, pure white. And today, when you're using paper napkins to save time, work, laundry bills, don't think they can't be crisp, fresh, starched-looking too. They can if you discover the whiter, crisper, fresher paper napkins, H-U-D-S-O-N, Hudson. Hudson paper napkins, a gleaming white, pure white, like fine linens. And they're crisp, starched-looking. You'll be proud to use them with your finest silver and tableware. And they're stronger, too. 64% stronger by actual laboratory tests. Hence, they won't tear easily, but will last through the entire meal. And they're pure, wholesome, sanitary. Safe to use with foods, for they're made of clean, fresh wood pulp, and processed by Hudson from tree to package. So get Hudson paper napkins in the pink and blue package. Use them at regular meals when you entertain. 80 Hudson paper napkins cost only a few pennies. And now, back to the news. In the Pacific, Australian and Dutch troops are pushing toward the oil fields on Tarakan Island in the Dutch East Indies. They've already seized a dominating hill in the center of Tarakan town, although the town itself is not in Allied hands. The oil fields are just to the east of the city, and they're burning furiously from Japanese demolitions and bombardments from Allied destroyers offshore. Two other Australian columns have captured the Tarakan airfield, and Australian engineers are repairing it for quick use by our planes. Meanwhile, General MacArthur has added another 11,000 dead Japs to the list of enemy casualties in the Philippines campaign. Most of this new bag of enemy dead was scored on Luzon Island, where American troops have been pushing beyond captured Baguio toward the northern Cagayan Plain. That's where most of the remaining Japs on Luzon are concentrated. There's no late news of the ground fighting in Okinawa since front dispatches reported the repulse of a furious Japanese counterattack north of Naha. This was the first large-scale Jap action since the Americans landed on Okinawa. About 3,000 of them stormed out of hidden caves and pillboxes, banked by a really heavy artillery bombardment. The Jap guns must have poured about 16,000 shells into our lines. However, the Jap effort was turned back by an even heavier load of firepower from our forces. About 50 American superfortresses made another attack today on those Jap suicide plane takeoff fields on Kyushu, following up a powerful sweep by lighter planes over Japan's inner sea lanes. Land-based Navy planes, possibly taking off from Okinawa, turned 20 Jap merchant ships into a mass of wreckage in the straits between Kyushu and Korea and in the Yellow Sea off western Korea. These are the sea lanes which connect Japan with her continental possessions. They're also the ones which support Japan's huge armies holding a grip on so much of China. Incidentally, that grip, though still powerful, has been loosened another notch. Chinese forces in western Hunan province have shattered the left wing of a Japanese offensive aimed at the American airbase city of Chikyang. The Chinese mounted their counterattack with four separate columns against the enemy's left wing. The entire Japanese 217th Regiment and 34th Division are reported to have been wiped out. From Calcutta comes a report on the British liberation of about 1,000 Allied prisoners at captured Rangoon, Burma, and some details on the harsh treatment many of them received. About 400 of the prisoners were Americans, most of them members of the Air Force, and they reveal how the Japs beat and starved them every time B-29 superfortresses raided Japan. Some of the Americans have arrived in Calcutta and are under treatment in a hospital. I'll be back in just a moment with a brief summary of the news. But first, all you mothers with young children, please listen. When your youngsters spill milk on the table or on themselves, you want a paper napkin that's extra absorbent so you can clean it up easily and quickly. And that's why I urge you to switch to Hudson paper napkins. They're heavier, 64% stronger by actual laboratory tests. Thus, they absorb far more moisture. They're ultra soft, too, and pure, gleaming white. What's more, they're wholesome, sanitary, safe to use even on baby's delicate skin. And here's why. Hudson paper napkins are made of only the finest, pure, fresh wood pulp from the far-off woods of Maine. And they're processed by Hudson from tree to package. So always insist upon this top-quality brand in the attractive pink and blue package. Today at your grocer's, get H-U-D-S-O-N, Hudson paper napkins. Hudson paper napkins cost only a few pennies. And now, a brief summary of the news. This is VE Day. Germany has surrendered unconditionally. In the Pacific, our troops are gaining on Luzon, and the Australians are going on Tarakan. Here at home, crowds are celebrating VE Day. Here's an item just come in. German-controlled Prague Radio broadcast a statement this afternoon that the German commander in Czechoslovakia has not recognized Admiral Dönitz's surrender. And that's the news to this moment. Here is an important announcement for telephone subscribers. Please do not use the phones for unnecessary calls, as central switchboards are tied up and important calls are not going through. Therefore, please do not use the phones. This program was brought to you by the Hudson Pulp and Paper Corporation, makers of fine paper products for the home. Hudson paper napkins, towels, and Hudson tissue. And now until 12:30 this afternoon, this is Henry Gladstone wishing you all a very pleasant morning.
Our next complete news broadcast will be at 11 o'clock with Prescott Robinson. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System. A transcription.
It's love on a two-day pass.
When the shy G.I. with the gleam in his eye
meets the lovely miss with the heart-stopping kiss.
In MGM's The Clock.
Starring Judy Garland.
And the lad you love is Private Hargrove, Robert Walker.
See the Clock, plus a great in-person show featuring Jane Froman, Willie Howard, and George Paxton and his orchestra. World premiere now at the Capitol Theater. WOR, New York.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? We are speaking to you now from the floor of the New York Curb Exchange, 86 Trinity Place in downtown Manhattan, where the news of VE Day has just been received a short while ago. This news was announced by General Eisenhower, but not confirmed by either of the three major powers. However, it seems fairly official right now that VE Day is with us. In this mammoth hall, where our mutual microphones are set up, traders are going about their business as usual, but as I look around at the different faces, I can see various expressions of emotion. Some are overjoyed, others just devoutly thankful that the war is over in Europe, but all seem to realize that there is still a big job ahead of us before final victory is achieved. At this present moment, a prayer is being read from the stage of the New York Curb Exchange by Dr. Frederick S. Fleming, rector of Trinity Church, after which a few words will be heard from Mr. Edward Doyle, Director of Publicity, and Mr. Edmund Ponsner, President of the New York Curb Exchange. At this present moment, everything is quiet here. A few moments ago, everything was all hustle and bustle at the New York Curb Exchange. Traders were running around like mad. The various lights on the call boards were flashing on and on, and there seemed to be a great deal of elation. People are going about their business, as I say, as usual, and going ahead, realizing that there's still an awful lot to be done. I think in the background, you can hear Dr. Fleming's prayer read. I'm pausing for just a moment so that you can hear the prayer itself. I'm afraid it isn't quite loud enough for you to hear, so I'll just keep on describing this scene. As I look about this mammoth hall, out the windows, I can see paper fluttering down the canyons of Broadway. Everybody is looking out of the window, and everybody seems to be waving and cheering. However, we can't hear it in here because, as I say, the windows are closed here, and business is going on as usual. The prayer is still going on, and in a few moments, I'm going to try and get Mr. Edward Doyle up to our microphone here. Mr. Doyle, do you mind saying a few words to our mutual listeners here, sir, about this great day, VE Day, which seems to be with us right now?
Thank you, Bob. It's a great day for us all, and we should all thank God and pray that we'll soon be over in the Pacific and have our boys back home again.
Well, that's a very fine sentiment, sir. I certainly thank you for coming up to our microphone. By the way, how do you think that VE Day will affect transactions down here on the New York Curb Exchange? Do you think that business will go on as usual today, or do you think that there will be a holiday or people will get off and sort of celebrate a little bit? Or do you think that they will realize that the best thing to do is just to stick to the job? What do you think, sir?
I believe we will carry on business the same as usual today.
I see. This prayer, sir, is being read, I understand, by Dr. Fleming of Trinity Church. Is that right?
Dr. Frederick Fleming of Trinity Church is kind enough to come over this morning and lead us in prayer.
I see.
It's a gesture, I think, especially
appropriate right now, yes, sir.
Time, yeah.
Yes, sir. And just before we came on the air, ladies and gentlemen, the mammoth brass bell rang, summoning people to the Curb Exchange and telling them that the Curb Exchange was in session at that time, and also calling them to this moment of devotion, which is being read now by Dr. Fleming. As I say, there is not very much activity at this present moment, but I think in just a moment, as soon as this prayer is over, we'll be able to give you some of the atmosphere of the New York Curb Exchange. As I walk along here, I'm passing through the various trading posts and walking over to the main trading post here, right in the center. I'm just about in the center of the New York Curb Exchange at this moment. Here is a gentleman here. I want to ask him a few questions. What is your name, please, sir?
Charles Leishner.
Mr. Leishner, and what firm are you connected with, sir?
Ernst & Company.
Ernst & Company. How does this news of VE Day hit you, sir?
I don't know. I can't talk.
You can't talk. What are your emotions, sir?
Just choked up, sort of.
Just choked up, sort of. Yeah. I think that's the sentiments of most of the people here.
They feel
very happy about VE Day being here, but they also realize that, well, the sacrifices that our boys have made on some of them who will never come back.
That's right.
Thank you very much, sir. And may I speak to this gentleman here, sir? Well, come on up. Say a few words.
Yeah.
What is your name, please, sir?
Jack Feinstein.
Jack Feinstein. Mm. And you're connected with Gilligan, Will & Company, is that right, sir?
Yeah, that's right.
And when did you hear the news of VE Day?
As I came in, about 20 minutes of 10.
20 minutes of 10?
Mm.
And how did you feel when you heard it?
Well, just the lightness that I was too speechless for words.
I see.
It stunned me.
Well, that's a very natural
all
reaction.
Choked, I don't know what to say.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, sir. And now I want to see if I can speak to somebody else over here. There's a gentleman over here. May I have a few words from you, sir? What is your name, please?
My name is Irving Reiner.
Mr. Reiner, are you a regular member down here on
the
New York Curtis
team? Yes, I am.
Yes. How do you feel about the great news of VE Day?
Well, I feel very, very happy, and I hope it'll bring peace forever after. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
1 minute.
And, oh, yes, we have Mr. Edwin Posner, president of the New York Curve Exchange. And, Mr. Posner, I want to have your reactions to VE Day.
Well, I think that we have received it with a feeling of suppressed excitement, exaltation, and humility, and with a realization that only half our job is done.
I see. Well, thank you very much, sir. And now, I see that our time is just about up here, ladies and gentlemen. We have been speaking to you from the floor of the New York Curve Exchange, 86 Trinity Place, and this is Bob Martin returning you now to our studios.
And now for our description of activities in Times Square, we take you to the marquee of the Hotel Astor. This is Bob Dixon speaking to you from the marquee of the Hotel Astor in Times Square in New York City. The marquee of the Hotel Astor, of course, faces directly east, approximately in the center of Times Square, and we have a clear vantage point in which we can see both left and right from the marquee. Excitement is rampant here in Times Square today, and no wonder. Many people, of course, are celebrating, but you can't hardly blame them for that. To our right, in front of the Times building, a large crowd is gathering. It seems to be growing larger by the minute. A lot of people are up there watching the various bulletins which are being posted upon the windows. And we can see people looking from windows of buildings, from the Times building. They're sitting on the ledge immediately overhead of where the news sign used to go around the building. To the left, way up as far as Duffy Square, the traffic is becoming just a bit congested due to the fact that so many people are walking across the street and walking on the sidewalks. Servicemen in uniform and servicewomen in uniform immediately below us here on the marquee of the Hotel Astor are looking exceedingly joyful indeed, and yet facing the situation with rather a serious note. There aren't too many smiles on them, but they seem to be relieved that the first half is over. As we said before, the traffic is becoming a little bit congested. The taxi cabs are lining up. The police are keeping them moving rather well, we think, in view of the existing conditions. Trolley cars, of course, are hampering the movement of both the pedestrians and also the taxi cabs and private cars as they go by. This crowd, which is gathering in front of the Times building and on the sides of the Times building, has now extended up to the replica of the Statue of Liberty, the 55-foot miniature, which was erected in Times Square, the last Warlone Drive, the 6th, I believe. And Pathé newsmen and also men from the Army Services, the newsmen from the Army Services, cameramen, are setting up their cameras in front of the Statue of Liberty at the moment and taking pictures of the crowd as it gathers in front of the Times building. There are many people on the sidewalks, not in uniform, people apparently who have come out from their businesses at the moment and are watching the progress of the bulletins in the Times building and crowding closer and closer to get a clear view of what each bulletin says. Crosstown traffic is progressing rather well in face of the conditions which are at the moment becoming a little bit excitable. Police are doing rather a remarkable job in keeping both the people and the traffic moving in orderly directions. Ticker tape is floating down from windows, the highest windows in the buildings that we can see, floating gradually down like snow on the people walking in the streets below. There has been a little bit construction work, I think the fixing of electric mains here in the street just below us, and that's been held up temporarily because of the fact that the traffic must move. And the workmen are also standing by and watching the proceedings as they go along. In front of the Hotel Claridge, which is immediately across the street and slightly to the right of us, long strips of paper are hanging from the various signs.
And now the long strip of paper is falling down on the crowd, and people are frantically tearing it away from their shoulders. It's a little bit unusual to have a large paper come floating down upon your head and not know exactly what it is. The crowd is rapidly getting larger in front of the Statue of Liberty and also in front of the Times building. People are coming from every direction to join the crowd, and we can hear outbursts of cheers as they view the various bulletins which are put up. The ticker tape is becoming a little bit thicker now. We can see down Broadway approximately as far as 41st to 40th Street, and the ticker tape floating in the air, some of it pink, other white, and some yellow, makes rather a pretty spectacle as the sun shines through it, coming down into Times Square. It's slightly hazy today, but the view that we have from our vantage point here is excellent. As we said before, the first half of this particular campaign is over. There's a great job to be done yet, and people are not celebrating quite as much as you might expect. We have just a minute more, and I'd like to explain now that the traffic is really tying up down here. However, the police are apparently gathering. I imagine they've been alerted for this particular occasion, and they are gathering in larger numbers and are able to keep most of the traffic moving. Of course, the pedestrians are walking all around the streets and apparently paying no attention to the traffic as it goes by at all, taking very good care of themselves, however, not to be struck by any traffic which is moving in their particular direction. The crowd down around the Times building is very large now. Of course, that includes 42nd and 43rd Street, and I imagine it's just a little bit difficult to get through. The crowd in front of the Statue of Liberty is very large now, and I think that's about all we can tell you from Times Square at the moment. And this will send you back now to our studios.
This is Dave Driscoll speaking from the Mutual Newsroom overlooking 7th Avenue and Broadway, a few blocks below the Hotel Astor, from which point you've heard a description of the scene there. Down on the streets, which are covered with white paper, almost like we'd had a heavy snowfall, people are all moving slowly up toward Times Square, which will be a mecca, no doubt, for later in the afternoon. Down to our left, the great paper snowstorm that began within a few seconds after the announcement was made on the air has subsided somewhat, but people are still throwing paper out across the way from us in small seams. Over in the river, I don't think you can hear it in the background because of the din of noise in the newsroom. We can hear a din of whistles from every craft in the harbor, in the Hudson River, and down in the lower bay. Up to our right, the paper snowstorm starts again, and one thing should be remembered. Paper is necessary to the war effort, so when a little fun has been had, let's stop throwing the paper, and that's a word of admonition for our New York listeners. I don't know whether, if I hold this microphone out, you can hear the sound of the whistles or not. At any rate, there's a rumble of whistles as we can hear them here, and still the paper comes down. Should be remembered, as we said, that paper is very necessary, and thousands of pages of newspaper will never be read because it is being tossed into the street. We brought you a description of the spontaneous outburst in New York from the Curb Exchange in Lower Manhattan in the Financial District from Times Square, the hub of New York and the crossroads of the world, and from this point overlooking Broadway and 7th Avenue just below Times Square. Undoubtedly, all over the nation, similar demonstrations are being made by other communities. Word has come through unofficially that the formal announcement of the surrender will not be made until later, as we've told you earlier, and there is some word that it may not be heard until afternoon Eastern wartime. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Keep tuned to WOR for all late news developments, as well as special broadcasts descriptive of activities throughout the city. The time is now 10:30. The Bamberger Broadcasting Service, WOR, New York.
10:30, and here's Bill Soder to say,
good morning. And I can say good morning in a way in which I've never been able to say it before, because I suppose this is the most tremendous moment in history. And I hope that good morning will continue and continue so that we can have a series of good mornings. The news is so immediate and coming in so rapidly from all quarters that we have decided not to have my wife's record, Bessie Beaters, coming in from San Francisco, because that would, of course, be a day or two late. So we will probably be interrupted, and we have as guests this morning Martha Graham and Sidney Mosley. And I think between us, we will probably be able to discuss the things of the moment. And I am sorry about Betty, but tomorrow, of course, I hope she will come in as usual. Mr. Mosley, we'll speak to Mr. Mosley first, shall we? Martha Graham?
Yes, please do.
Tell us what, if it's possible, I mean, to express your feelings. I know one cannot do it. You know, I feel, if I may just digress for a moment, I feel like the soldier who was asked on last Saturday week what his feelings were when the false report came in. And he said, how can I say anything to a man? I mean, there's only one being who understands me, and that's God. And I think he was quite right.
I think he was. Today, one feels rather somber. I do. Of course, you've heard over the air just now the rejoicings which is taking place in New York and other parts of the country. That's very natural. We've been under a strain for a time. I think today is a day of rejoicing and a day of prayer and a day in which we must not forget that there's a war still to be fought in Japan, but it's also a day for retrospection. From now on, we've got to do a lot of thinking about what happened if we're to learn anything from the great sacrifice in blood, sweat, and tears that we've made. We've got to go back and ask ourselves why this war took place, what we've got to do to prevent it from recurring, what lessons we've learned. It's no good rejoicing and going crazy and then getting back onto the old pattern. And therefore, today, I must say that I feel probably more grave than I've been for a long time. And in the first place, the war in Europe is not over. The real war, the war to combat suffering, the war to prevent chaos, a chaos which might finally achieve the designs of Hitler. He said he was going to bring down the world with him. He's failed. He himself had been brought down. But the state of Europe is such today that we've got to concentrate on putting Europe back on its feet. And that is a point which we cannot afford to forget. The stories that I've been hearing from Europe are almost incredible. The stories of Germany, the conditions inside Germany, are much worse than we've been led to believe. Now, the average man will say, well, let Germany go to perdition. But we're unable to do that. We are part of the pattern over there. We, the Allies, are to take possession of Germany. And the responsibility of the reconstruction in Germany will be ours. Our own Allied headquarters will be set up there. And no doubt, they will try hard to show what democracy is capable of achieving in the rebuilding of Germany. And that is the amazing thing, that despite the punishment, the guilt of Germany, we may have to start on her first in putting her back on her feet. Well, even so, she will have suffered, and there's not the slightest doubt about it, that this generation of Germany, and the next, will remember, even as they look around, that war doesn't pay. But we've also got to do a lot of remembering. We've got to avoid the unpreparedness. We've got to avoid the Munich. We've got to avoid the lack of understanding between nations. I am very interested indeed in that one point, the fact that neither America nor Britain knew sufficiently of one another, that they were ill-informed, that neither Washington nor London made preparations for the peoples of either country to understand what their problems were. And it was only long after war started that America began to hear of the true problems which had faced Britain, and vice versa. What are we going to do about that? Are we going to shut down at once like an oysters after this is all over and rejoice? No, there's plenty of work to be done. And that is one of the thoughts that occurs to me this morning, as some people rejoice, as some people sit tearful in memories of their lost ones, those of us who still think of the war ahead in Japan, and those of us who think of the greater tasks ahead to rebuild a better and happier world, a world which will be safe from future aggression.
Sidney, how deeply do you feel that the seeds of Nazism have been sown in the youth of Germany?
Well, I think very deeply, although even there, I think that there were some youths who saw through it. There were some, I'm one of those who believe that there is a nucleus, a very small nucleus inside Germany, who have been compelled to go along with Nazism. It's not so easy when you get a government of hooligans with the organization they had. It's very difficult to kick against them. No doubt that the entire German nation will have to suffer, and rightly so. One of the big jobs we've got to do, which we haven't started to do even now, is the punishment of the tremendous number of Nazi criminals. We've spoken a lot about it, but we have no plans. We have no plans for the immediate punishment of vast numbers. I spoke to a German a little while ago, and he said, if you gave me the opportunity of trying those Nazi criminals, he said, I would dispose of 500,000. When he spoke about disposing of them, he meant that he would deal with them summarily. Those are the people who must pay for the terrible deeds committed inside Germany. As for the rest, the youngsters, after all, and Germans are being born every day, and there are Germans who are prepared to teach them, to show them the light. I believe we can deal with that in time. It's going to take some time. But primarily, the job is to let Germany know that at any rate the English-speaking nations are prepared for any tricks they may try to play again.
You know, I read the other day, I mean, you were speaking just now about what we will have to do to rehabilitate even Germany itself. And as far as I can remember it, the Russians who have suffered were doing just that very thing already when they were coming into the German villages. It sounded so marvelous to me that these people should be doing it. Of course, they have to do it.
Surely.
There's no question about that.
Yes, and the Russians deny that they're bloodthirsty about it. They certainly have scores to pay, and they will pay them. They have undoubtedly treated their Nazi prisoners a little more realistically than we have over here. And it's time now, at any rate, that we've had the excuse that we've been pretty soft with these Nazi criminals because we were afraid of what they might do in turn to our prisoners over the other side. But now I think we ought to get very tough, because among those Nazi criminals over here are men who are responsible for some of the bloody deeds we've been reading about. That is one form of education. In fact, Germany fairly well, but those who know it even better will tell you that one of the ways to teach the German is to show that who is master, and to be tough, and to make them realize that crime doesn't pay. That is a job that we've got to do in the setting up of this new League of Nations. And primarily, again, I say that there must be a fundamental understanding, a clear understanding between Britain and America on this point. And with such a combination, we can be certain that that can never happen again.
Martha Graham, is it possible for me, is it reasonable for me to ask you what you feel just at the present time? I mean, probably you may answer just like that soldier. Only God can understand you. But it'd be nice to get an expression of your opinion.
Well, I agree with Mr. Mosley. It's a time for grave consideration and thought and a dedication of oneself to these tremendous things that are facing us. Of course, I suppose everyone's thoughts turn to some specific people, some specific person he or she knows in the midst of all of this. My thought turns to the men who are fighting in Europe, who have been in my company, the man, Lieutenant David Zellmer, who returned yesterday from his 50 missions over Japan, and I'm wondering what they think at this time. And the whole, I know that we all have to work harder, with more dedication than we've ever done before. I know the story came through that when the Russians moved in again into conquered places, places that the Germans had occupied in Russia, they started an educational program at once for the children in those Russian towns. They picked the children up off the streets, and within 10 days, they had those children in a dance class so that they could be organized, could be disciplined, and could have some outlet for their emotional energies at that time. And I think that's quite an amazing thing, because in the midst of devastation, of grief, and war, that this thing should touch. Now, I mustn't take time, because I know there are much more immediate things.
Because after all, so, we have...
I'll turn you back, Mr. Mosley.
Well,
there's a lot to be said. We can go on talking for hours.
There's too much.
On what is happening today, what is likely to happen tomorrow, and in the far future.
Sidney Bird, Martha Graham and I were having a talk the other day, and she was speaking about some of the young men who had been in her company and who are now at the front. I think that story about the paratrooper, tell us that, Martha Graham, will you?
Well, there's one man who's jumped in every invasion. That is, he's just out of the hospital. His name is David Stewart. And he's a great big boy, but his one, of course, worry when he came out of the hospital was that he'd never dance again. I think he will. We hope he will. He's still a little lame.
Uh-huh.
But I hope he will. But he has a courage, an iron, a discipline, which sometimes the arts do give one.
Surely. And the marvels of surgery today.
I know. That's
ought to be a consolation to everybody who has had somebody wounded.
Yes.
They will be whole again.
That's the really encouraging thing.
Yeah. Well, as most of our listeners know, Mutual is doing its best, and WOR, to make a complete coverage of this VE Day. Now, we've heard just before this program went on the air from Times Square and from the Curb Exchange, and also Dave Driscoll from this particular building. But right now, we're going to go to Washington for a report by Walter Compton. He is Mutual's reporter in Washington. And to hear from Walter, we're going to take our listeners to Washington.
House this morning, ladies and gentlemen, about 100 to 150 news people over there waiting anxiously for some report from the White House on the surrender of the German nation to all of the Allies. At about 10:15 this morning, we were notified that press and radio secretary Jonathan Daniels would have a conference, and so everyone trooped into the office of Mr. Daniels. He was wearing a brown suit. He didn't look any more excited than he usually does. He's rather an imperturbable chap. He waited till we all got into the room, and then very calmly he said, "All I have for you this morning, gentlemen, is a proclamation from the President of the United States." Smiling broadly as everyone jumped, he said, "There will be National Rehabilitation Week on the 2nd of June." That was the strength of the proclamation. However, the newsmen did question Mr. Daniels. He said that the White House, in concerning the surrender, had nothing to announce at this time regarding the situation in Europe. He said that President Truman has planned, as was announced a week ago, to make a radio broadcast to the nation in the event of the cessation of hostilities. He didn't go any further than that. Now, shortly before Daniels talked with the reporters, he conferred with Elmer Davis, who is the director of the Office of War Information. Mr. Davis said that he had come to the White House to get some documents that he would need in his business. He wouldn't identify the documents. It seemed, however, that it was a fair assumption to make that they included some sort of textual matter to be broadcast to the world by OWI once VE Day is proclaimed officially. As to the new peace reports from abroad, Daniels confined himself to the statement that the fact is that there is no official announcement at the White House at this moment. And for your information, the people of Washington and the District of Columbia are accepting that as gospel. In contrast to many another spot in this nation, there is no excitement in Washington to speak of. F Street and 14th Street, our major corner in town, is reported to be completely quiet. There is no excitement in Washington, and doubtless there will be none. We've already had one VE Day, a Saturday a week ago. Possibly we're a little cured here. At any rate, for the moment, there is no further news from the White House. There is no proclamation stated by the President, or none is scheduled for the moment. We take you now to San Francisco.
From the Mutual Newsroom in San Francisco, we bring you important late developments on the situation in Germany, and we have with us Mr. Royal Arch Dennison of our reporting staff, who has prepared some special information taken from his observations as a reporter in the Pacific. We bring you now Royal Arch Dennison.
Yes, indeed, this is the day. And here we are in the middle of Monday, May 7th, and what does that mean? The first thing that flashes into my mind as this historic moment hits the world is that it was May 7, 1942, that our men, our American troops, surrendered to the Japs on the island of Corregidor. And that carries me right on to what this surrender is going to mean to the war in the Far East, to the American troops, sailors, airmen, to the Chinese, and to the Japs. In the first place, I'm sure the boys in the Pacific and in China-Burma won't react too violently, and that may seem strange for me to say. But if I know the boys with whom I've been making landings and fighting through the jungles and over the Jap beaches, the reaction is going to be something like this. Okay, they'll say, okay, leave us get on with the Japs. I just hope the folks at home don't think the war has ended now that Hitler's folded. And it's been the constant fear of the boys out there that come VE Day here at home, we will think the war is over and that the Japs are going to be easy one-handed to clean up. Therefore, they feel the war might drag on and they'll never get home. To be sure, this is a great day. To be sure, it means the end of the greatest slaughter of human life ever carried out in the world's history in Europe or anywhere else. But that slaughter is still going on in East Asia. Americans everywhere here at home have gone wild, and there's only one day that will find a greater celebration, and that day, of course, is going to be on the day we hear the announcement that MacArthur and Nimitz have taken over the Japs. And now for one or two more points, remember the end of the fighting in Europe does not mean that everyone's husband and son and brother will be coming home. I know you've heard this before, but there's been much confusion over the point. Now the transfer of troops across America and down through the Suez Canal will begin to take place, and this takes time. And what's to be expected in the Far East from Japan as a result of this announcement? Well, let me tell you what we know of the Jap plans for this fold-up of the Germans. In the first place, it's been the Japanese feeling for at least 2 years that we Americans and the British are going to be so tired out that we'll be willing to accept a deal, some kind of conditional surrender from the Japs. They're hoping that we might be so tired of war that we'd be willing to leave certain territories still in Jap hands just to have the war end now. And are they going to be surprised? Well, that's why it's likely that within a few weeks or even less, the Japs will make some kind of a peace offer to the United States, just as they've been making to the Chinese. But what the Japs are most worried about today, just as sure as you and I are celebrating the German surrender and VE Day, is that the Russians are now going to turn on the Japs. And, of course, that's the next big step that may be expected in the Far East. The Russians have constantly indicated to the Allied High Command as early as the Tehran Conference that come VE Day, they would then begin to give their full attention to what they have constantly and very reservedly called the crisis in the Far East. Well, here in San Francisco today, we have probably the largest array of top diplomats the world has ever had in one place when a world crisis has occurred. It's interesting to note that over the weekend, several of the foreign ministers have moved out, either to return to their own countries or to Washington. The tip-off came to the diplomats on Saturday night. Some of them felt it was wise to stay here and finish up the plans for the World Security Organization. They felt the organization will be needed quickly, and it will, and that's why Eden and Stettinius and Molotov have stuck close. It's possible now that the San Francisco conference will speed up its work, and the charter will be presented to the 49 governments just as fast as it's feasible for ratification. There's still a terrific amount of fighting to be done, and this point is stressed by every foreign minister and top official I've talked with since early morning when members of the mutual staff got on the phone and advised most of the leading delegates that the war was over. You'll be interested in the comments that we've had, and before long, we'll be able to bring you direct from this mutual booth right here in San Francisco, in the Veterans Building, many of these officials. Yes, indeed, this is the day to begin the real blast against the final enemy, those bandy-legged little sons of the Son of Heaven. And this is Royal Arch Gunnison.
Now for personal observations from Mr. Charles Hodges, whose many years of observation of international relations in Europe has made him one of the nation's foremost students, and he brings you some of these personal observations now. Charles Hodges.
As statesmen see their handiwork, it's over in Europe. The Nazi foreign minister has told the German people that Hitler's new order is finished. The catastrophe has overtaken the Nazi dream of a thousand-year Reich over Europe, that the terms of surrender are harsh. This means that the Second World War is ending in the West, but it is only the military end. Now we come to the critical phase of the European battle, the securing of political victory. Everything depends on what's happened to the Germans under Hitlerism. I saw these Germans in 1932 divide into two armed camps of political fighters. The Berlin street corners ran blood as the Nazis and the communists slugged it out. The Social Democrats, on whom we counted for peace in our time, simply watched that fight for power. And that fight from street corner to chancellery devoured the Democratic Republic. Instead of Kaiserism, we had Hitlerism. I saw these Germans begin their Nazi march of death 1 year later, with Hitler in office and his Nazi gangsters burning the Reichstag, a bonfire of democracy for the new German Führer. I saw these Germans in 1936 come out in the open. Hitler pulled a drawer open in the Imperial Chancellery when the German generals protested his bold plan to seize the Rhineland. This went ahead because Hitler offered them to shoot himself if the move failed. It did not fail, and rearmed Germany began its planned aggression on its neighbors. And I saw Nazified Germany defiant on the eve of Munich, that grim finale to our appeasement. Germany stood as an old Teutonic war host, reborn under Hitler in a new tribal loyalty. Here's the one thing that runs through Germany between World War I and World War II. It's the German acceptance of authority, the boss word that comes from above. Just remember this one thing. The German functions differently from us. That's why he's been all out for Hitler during 6 years of global war. It's not the yah-yah. It's the nine, the no, that makes Fritz tick. Eisenhower shows that he knows this. Montgomery and our own generals have barked the command that the Wehrmacht understands. It's up to us to put Allied authority across politically now. Give the German people the nine, the no, that makes them tick, tick our way. Our supreme command has hit its stride, and the Germans know it. This Second World War winds up far differently from World War I. The mighty Wehrmacht has collapsed on the soil of the German fatherland, before the eyes of bomb-happy German civilians. They now know the full horror of the round-the-clock bombing that their own Luftwaffe started, but American and British air power have finished. There can be no myth of Allied trickery for another generation of Germans. There are no terms, just these two fateful words, unconditional surrender. These two words are the life insurance of civilization. Upon them, out here in San Francisco, depends the future of our own new world charter. This cleanup of the supreme aggressor clears the boards. For the defeat of Japan can be clinched within 12 months if the full force of the Big Three turns to the Pacific. We now can plan with European certainties and Pacific probabilities. But it also means something else. Every effort is going to be made in the next fortnight here at the United Nations Conference on International Organization to speed the framework for future world peace. This collapse of German resistance will resolve disputes at San Francisco. It's my opinion, with dramatic rapidity. The world simply can't wait on diplomatic bickering here at San Francisco. There won't be a lost moment from this memorable day to the final signing of the charter. There just isn't room for delay, as every foreign minister remaining here knows.
From San Francisco, we've brought you comments by Royal Arch Benison and Charles Hodges. For continued developments in these important news hours, we take you now to New York.
Mutual presents Cecil Brown, internationally known correspondent, reporter, and commentator. Mr. Brown.
This is the day that so many people died to bring about. After almost 6 years of war, the German military machine is a beaten, destroyed thing. That fact has been evident for some time, but this is the official VE Day, Victory Day in Europe, after 5 years, 8 months, and 6 days. The Germany that was to endure for 1,000 years died after about 2,000 days of war. The joy of people all over the world is great, but it is somewhat restrained, too. People in Europe are tired down to the very marrow of their bones. Many are hungry. Millions are without homes. In their eyes, you can see how many bombs came crashing down around them for so many years. In America, the joy is great, but it is not wild. It cannot be, because almost all of us are very well aware that the war is not over. Too many Americans are in the Pacific theater for Americans to have any idea that the war has ended. The Germans have done in Europe the kind of a job that they wanted to do. It's estimated that some 40 million people have been killed, wounded, or are missing in Europe. The United Nations have spent about $500 billion to fight and win this war. The Axis powers in Europe spent about half that amount. The money expenditure has been great, but even greater has been the expenditure of manpower, not only of those who died, but the wreckage among the survivors. The fighting has stopped in Europe, but disease threatens so many of the people there. Their transition from war to peace will not be an easy job. Many are undernourished and subject to all kinds of diseases. The danger of epidemics is great, and the health services of the United Nations have a huge job before them. So have the organizations designed to get food to people all over Europe. This coming winter in Europe is expected to be the most severe, so far as food is concerned, that Europe has experienced since the war started in 1939. But the military problems are still tremendous. An estimated 10 million German soldiers are now prisoners. They are expected to remain in that status until a peace treaty is signed, but it may be many years before a formal peace treaty is signed. Those 10 million German soldiers become the charges of the United Nations. They have to be sorted out, distributed into various sections of Germany, or used for repair work in various countries of Europe. So did 60 million German civilians become the charges of the United Nations. For the problem of what to do with Germany now becomes an immediate task. It must be dealt with right away. Now that VE Day is here, the whole machinery for the occupation of Germany swings into operation. That occupation presents greater difficulties than have ever faced any occupying authorities. First off, it remains to be seen whether all German troops will obey the orders of Admiral Karl Dönitz to surrender. Of course, the German general and admiral who signed the papers for unconditional surrender said that all Germans and Germany would obey the terms of surrender. But the world is not going to be naive enough to take the word of the German nation, or those who say they speak for it, or of any German officers. The main job is the direct occupation of Germany. As you may know, Germany is going to be divided into four areas for occupation purposes. The Russians will have eastern Germany, the Americans will be in the south, the French in the Rhineland area, and the British in the north. Many understandings have to be reached among the Big Four on the occupation program. The machinery is not all ready. It has to be improvised from day to day. That is going to take great goodwill and understanding between the Americans, Russians, British, and French. Those problems are so great that it would be understandable if the joy over VE Day were somewhat restrained. For as tough as winning the war was, the task of winning the peace will be just as hard and quite as dangerous.
Mutual has presented Cecil Brown, internationally known correspondent, reporter, and commentator. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
A transcription.
Mighty fine homemade pie, if fine make a lemon pie this way. Folks will call for more, so just ask your store for mighty fine today.
Mighty fine lemon pie filling makes real homemade lemon pies.